Good morning and welcome to the June 15th edition of Mountain Money. I'm your co-host, Roger Goldman. I'm here with my co-host, Kevin Kennedy. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Roger. Good morning, everyone in the Wasatch Pack.
We've got a great show today. We're actually going to spend our entire hour speaking with author Jeff Winters. His book is called The Blind Spot, How Oligarchs Dominate Our Democracy. Should be a great conversation.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Author Jeffrey Winters argues that although the wealthy and powerful few have dominated the many throughout human history, we're now in an era of what he calls in-your-face oligarchy. In his new book, The Blind Spot, How Oligarchs Dominate Our Democracy, Winters traces the evolution of the power of the wealthy throughout history and discusses the paradox of their growing dominance in democratic societies. We're very lucky to be joined by him this morning. Good morning and welcome to Mountain Money.
It's great to be here. Thank you, Roger.
So tell us what motivated you to write this book and how long did it take to do the research?
Well, I worked on the book for about 5 years for the research, and it took about 2 years of full-time writing to complete it. And the motivation really was back in 2011, I wrote a book on oligarchy itself. It was a political science-y book, and I decided I really wanted to write a book that was not necessarily for my political science colleagues, but for the general public, and to look at the issue more from the democratic side, to ask, what's the nature of our democracy as it interacts with oligarchy?
You know, you hear so many times comments about why do people keep voting against their interests, right? Their economic interests. And I guess that's another way of asking some of the questions that you're asking, right? Which is, how do we get there? What exactly is the blind spot?
Yeah, the blind spot, it's a sort of mistaken idea we have. And so I'm trying to clarify through this book. First of all, democracy works in a certain sense. That is, horizontally among us, the non-rich. So, for example, if we marginalize different groups throughout history, women didn't have the vote on the basis of race or other things, struggles among the non-rich to be included have actually worked. And so we see that democracy is definitely functional. And we think that because democracy works in that sense among ourselves, that it will also work between the many and the few. That is, if, for example, democratically, we want to do something about inequality, we think that we can. And the blind spot is about the idea that actually things are structured so that we can't. That is what I'm trying to reveal.
So therefore, the wealth gap isn't a flaw in our democracy, right? It is deliberately designed from the beginning.
That's right. So think of it as, let's start with the problem. The problem is, here we are now 250 years into the modern democratic era, and we are definitely more democratic as a country than we were at the beginning. So democracy has been improving. And yet the paradox or the puzzle is, how is it that we have become more unequal over that same period? And inequality has exploded in the United States. And so that sort of doesn't make sense. How is it that a democratic people are not able to moderate, limit how unequal we are? And if you look at polls done by Pew and everyone else, actually, the vast majority of Americans want the society to be more equal. They're not happy with the levels of inequality they're seeing. And I would even go further as to say that another part of the puzzle is, you know, inequality is not new. So think of inequality in society as being sort of a wealth pyramid. This goes back a very, very long time in human civilization. But here's what's different. That inequality has always been sustained by authoritarianism, by fear, by force, by awe. And here we are now in a very, very unequal society, and we're participating. It's democratic. That has never happened before in human history. And so the puzzle is, how is it that we are so equal and yet so unequal?
Talk just for a minute about how current levels of wealth and income disparity compare to those in the past, and even as recently as the 1970s.
Yeah. So let me do two comparisons, one to the 1970s and one also to the ancient world. So all of us are familiar with Imperial Rome, and we know that it was authoritarian, dominated by a few hundred Roman senators who were the oligarchs of the time. So if we take the question, what was the average oligarch or senator in Imperial Rome, and how much richer were they than the average person in Imperial Rome? And it turns out that's about 16,000 to 1, which is very unequal. That's a very steep wealth pyramid of the time. Fast forward to the United States. How unequal are we today? Well, we are now at about 140,000. We are 8 or 9 times more unequal than authoritarian, you know, dictatorship, Imperial Rome.
Let me stop just for a second. What are we comparing? What is the 140,000 to the one? Help us understand what that ratio is.
So if you take the average person of the Forbes 400.
Okay, that's who that is. Okay.
Average person of the Forbes 400 versus the median wealth position in the United States. But you also asked about the difference between the 1970s and now. And that moment, let's say 1975, is an incredibly important turning point because it is the inflection point at which today's incredible explosion of inequality started. Basically 50 years ago, we are now 50 years into an extreme wealth concentration and also rising precarity, rising insecurity among the middle and among the majority of people in society, which, by the way, explains a lot of the fragmentation we're seeing in society, a lot of the polarization. Let's just put it this way. People are willing to be a lot more generous under conditions of security and a sense of growing prosperity than they are under conditions of difficulty. And so if you take the inequality of 1975 and you compare it to the inequality of today, if we could just have that inequality of 1975, the median household would have 60 to 80% more wealth and income than they have. In other words, $55 trillion has shifted upward over the last 50 years. It's extraordinary. It's really, really extraordinary. And if we ask the question, well, what is the consequence of this inequality? I give an example in the book of something as simple as life expectancy. And if first of all, globally, the top 1% in the oligarchs live 25 years longer than the average person in the bottom half. That's the first point. And so this is just, you know, people are paying an early grave price for inequality. Even in the United States, the people at the top live 10 to 15 years longer than the people down below.
And just as an aside, you talk a lot about the U.S., but the numbers are not all that dissimilar in other Western democracies, I take it.
That's actually true. And a lot of people who follow these things, they would say, well, there's the Scandinavian, relatively democratic socialist countries with a lot of welfare. And here's what it turns out you find when you dig into the numbers. Yes, they do have a stronger welfare system so that the bottom is pulled up more than, for example, in the United States. That's true. But here's the reality. It is based on regressive taxation. So the oligarchs in the Scandinavian countries are not paying for that welfare. It's being paid for by the mass affluent and the people below them. So it is basically redistribution among the non-rich. That's how it's actually happening.
Because it's taxes like tariffs and other kinds of regressive.
It's tariffs and value-added taxes, VATs. It's consumer taxes. And it turns out those Scandinavian countries are as unable to tax the ultra wealthy as we are.
And that leads us to an industry that you coined, this wonderful term, the wealth defense industry, a term I had not heard before. Tell us what you mean by that.
Yeah, that I actually came up with that term in 2011 in the first oligarchy book. What is the wealth defense industry? Okay, first of all, it arises in after the Second World War. It starts in the 50s, really gains momentum in the 60s, and by the 1970s, it is becoming a matured industry. And what is it? Well, tax rates coming out of the Second World War era, because of setbacks that oligarchs had actually experienced due to war, depression, and everything else, tax rates, the highest bracket, was 91%. Okay? And the very, very wealthy were willing to do anything they could to not pay those tax rates. And so a group of lawyers, accountants, wealth management professionals, lobbyists, and others began to form into a networked industry. Hmm. And that industry arose for one purpose: A, to help knock down, to do the political battle on behalf of oligarchs to knock those tax rates down to what they are now. So there were about 27 tax brackets right after the Second World War, and 91% tax rate. We're now down to 7 brackets and 37%. So it's a great, you know, it's been a very successful industry in terms of advocating in that sense. But they also provide another service, which is less visible than the political battle of fighting over tax brackets. In fact, it's completely invisible. And that is, whatever the tax brackets end up being, the wealth defense industry exists for one purpose: to make sure oligarchs don't pay it, and that their what is called their effective tax rate. So you've got the bracket mm-hmm. rate, and then the effective tax rate is what do they actually pay, to make sure that it is single digit.
Yeah.
So the ultra wealthy are paying somewhere between 1.5% and 8% in reality. And meanwhile, the actual change over that same period from the 1950s, 1960s for the average person is much smaller. So it's all the changes in the tax system have been beneficial to those at the very top. And so this industry has people in it whose sole job is to master the tax code. And people within this industry, by the way, they don't even master the whole tax code. It's so complex that sometimes they master only a part of it, a single chapter, a single section, but they are the one you go to if you want to navigate that part. We have 80,000 pages of tax code. Much of that was actually draft written by the wealth defense industry and adopted. So they write it and then they work it. And meanwhile, the rest of us just have our standard W-2, all of our money is taken in advance, and we do what we can to try to hold on to it.
Right. So your typical W-2 employee pays, you know, Social Security, Medicare, and whatever the withholding is, and there's really no room for any kind of shenanigans like this. It's very straightforward. And that's why the effective tax rate on middle-class Americans is probably much higher.
Oh, yes. In fact, I call us, we're turbo taxpayers. We basically run an app to try to get through the 1040, and it asks you, did you move this year? Are you a veteran? Those are your big deductions, ladies and gentlemen. Now you do have a standard deduction. That's there in place for you. But what goes on for oligarchs is just another world entirely.
And you point out something that, you know, in my career as a former big firm lawyer, I certainly saw, which is this cycle where young lawyers will go to work for the IRS, will go to work for the Joint Committee on Taxation. They will get some experience. They will, you know, seek to do their job as government lawyers. But then they will then take that knowledge and go to work for big law firms, big accounting firms, and turn right around and use what they have learned. And with a great deal more resources, all of a sudden they can marshal armies of lawyers, right? To deal with these young, underpaid Justice Department lawyers.
Yeah. In fact, going back decades, people inside government, leaders inside government have said, basically, we are a tuition-free school for how to
get around the Department of Justice, how to get around the IRS, because folks, many start out. In fact, even to get a job in the wealth defense industry, it's very important to have come from the government offices themselves, because then you've got a network of contacts. You also know exactly how it works. And so this is a real asset for someone who's trying to get employed in this industry. But there's another dimension to it, Roger, and that is there's something I call infiltration. This is a very interesting part of it. We normally think of the revolving door as someone starts in government, they know whether they're in Congress or whether they're a staffer, that eventually they're going to have an opportunity to leave and cash in and finally make some money working for whatever it was the industry or sector they were regulating, right? Here's what infiltration is. You start at KPMG or Deloitte as a junior member. You then leave and go for a roughly three-year stint inside the government. In this case, one of the key targets of the wealth defense industry is an office called the Office of Tax Policy. No one's heard of it. No one knows it's even there in the Department of Treasury. What does it do? It takes the statutes that are passed by Congress, and its job is to come up with the implementing regulations. How do you actually do it? And that office, over the last five or six presidencies, has been completely populated by people who rotate in from the wealth defense industry. And they spend about 3 years there after they work on behalf of their clients to make sure that all of the policies for the wealthy are put in place. They rotate back out, get $1 million salary, and become partner.
So chapter three, you started out as like a James Bond movie, you know, clandestine effort to obtain evidence of shady international tax evasion. What was the Castle Bank investigation, and what does its ultimate conclusion tell us about the power of the wealth defense industry?
Well, that's it's a real sort of thriller.
and I got to say, you know, it's not easy to turn a tax story into a thriller because most people's eyes glaze over. Mm-hmm. But basically, think of it like this. First of all, there is within the IRS a group called special agents. They're armed with Glocks. We normally think of the IRS full of, you know, people with green eye shades and accountants and auditors and so on. These people, and there are a few thousand of them, their job is to actually go after people like Al Capone and others. That's where they originated. And in the 1970s, there was a group of special agents in the Miami office whose job was actually to go after money laundering and tax evasion by mobsters and the syndicates. That's what they thought they were doing. And so a guy named Richard Jaffe, who was just really good at his job, decided to set up an intelligence network in the Caribbean, where he had paid informants, which was actually IRS policy to have paid informants. This is intelligence work they're doing. And so they stumbled upon Castle Bank. Castle Bank, it turns out, and there's a fascinating story of how first one of his paid informants infiltrates it, and then for reasons I won't go into, they became suspicious of what was going on in Castle Bank, and they needed to know who were Castle Bank's clients. But this was a very secretive offshore bank in the Bahamas. And so the question was how to get the client list. And a sting operation of sorts was set up. This infiltrator had figured out that there was a weak link inside the bank. There was a randy vice president who wanted to get hooked up. And so what they did was they knew that he was going to be passing from Nassau through Miami up to Chicago, where I am, to see the owner of Castle Bank and one of the founding attorneys of the wealth defense industry. But he stopped in Miami and he was picked up at the airport by a beautiful young woman who, it turns out, was also an informant and had gone to the police academy. A dinner was arranged, and he dropped his briefcase at her apartment before they went off to dinner. The IRS special agent guys had their informant go in, using her key, got the briefcase, photographed all the documents inside while they were having dinner, and the briefcase gets returned to the exact same spot in the apartment. They come back from dinner. She hands him the briefcase, says good night. That was it. Well, it turns out they had photographed the documents that they got, and the subsequent information they were able to get showed that there were roughly 300 oligarchs from America who had, so he didn't find mobsters. He found incredibly wealthy business people and other prominent Americans, prominent names, Ford, Pritzker, and so on, were all had secret accounts and were engaging in massive tax evasion in Castle Bank. And long story short, these guys in the Miami office who thought, oh my God, we're going to be legends in the IRS for this discovery. We have developed techniques that are going to allow us to see what we could not previously see. We have pierced through the wall of non-transparency. They thought, we're going to be famous. Well, what they didn't expect was that they themselves would be crushed, that their careers would all be destroyed. It turns out everything they did, including what later was called the briefcase caper, everything they did was legal. It went all the way up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court found that what they had done was legal, but it was too late by the time we got that decision, because the damage had been done, and even Donald Alexander, who was the IRS commissioner at the time, appointed by Nixon, he came from the wealth defense industry. He had spent his entire career defending oligarchs and creating tax shelters. He destroyed this group of special agents in Miami.
And what eventually happened to Agent Jaffe?
Agent Jaffe, he was able to, after being investigated multiple times, they tried to fire him. He had been brought before a grand jury. All of that failed. He was able ultimately to retire. And he spent many years after that trying to make sure people would know about this case and what had happened.
And the rationale for not allowing the case to go forward, for not allowing the evidence they had gathered to be used to go after these tax, this tax evasion schemes, what was the rationale given?
Well, Don Alexander, the commissioner of the IRS, claimed that constitutional rights had been violated in taking the briefcase. Well, it turns out, yes, for the vice president who was passing through, his Fourth Amendment rights had been violated. True, but not for the names of the people in the briefcase. And the claim by the commissioner was that it was all tainted. It was not all tainted, but that's what got out to all the attorneys. So suddenly the IRS and the Department of Justice found themselves inundated with thousands of lawyers from those 300 oligarchs, inundating them with freedom of information requests and threatening them. If you bring a case, we will go for defamation and other kinds of things. Don't you dare. So it turns out not a single one of the 300 people who had engaged in massive tax evasion at Castle Bank in the Bahamas was actually ever found guilty and had to pay any back taxes.
Now I'm sitting here saying, it's funny, I've never heard of this, and I imagine a lot of listeners are saying the same thing. Was it a big cover-up to make sure this information did not really go that public?
Well, the one reason we haven't heard of it is because it wasn't successful.
Right.
Right? Had Richard Jaffe and his team actually blown up Castle Bank, and had those people been brought to trial, he and his team would be legends in the IRS. But because they were crushed and because all the cases were undone and the whole thing collapsed, it disappeared. At the time, you know, Jack Anderson and other famous journalists were following the case, and there was documentation of this in Miami. The Miami Herald and others had been, I mean, there was testimony in front of Congress about this. So the case in the 1970s was alive and it was being talked about. But because the oligarchs won, and none of them were you know, charged with anything, it disappeared. And so I'm sort of excavating that story. I'm bringing it back. And the reason I do it is not just because, the implications are that it was a turning point. Why? Because what Jaffe's team had done is that they had developed intelligence techniques to be able to actually see and find the money that was hidden offshore. And those techniques were themselves undone and shut down. And so it was a moment when the wealth defense industry triumphed, and those chasing after the money not only failed, but were destroyed.
And you choose this story as emblematic of the way in which the wealth defense industry and the bureaucracy stands up to protect the oligarchs. And you spend a lot of time on it, but I think that's why, right?
That's why, because we need to understand that first of all, how powerful this industry is, but also the damage that was done to the one institution, the IRS, that can actually go after oligarchs. And ever since then, the IRS has been a target, cutting its budget, cutting its capacity. And a lot of Americans sign on to that. You know, it's sometimes when I'm speaking in front of audiences and I say, believe it or not, ladies and gentlemen, the IRS is your friend. It's a tough sell to try to get people on the IRS's side. But here's what they don't know about the IRS. For everybody who's got a W-2, for every ordinary American, everything about your taxes is done automatically and computerized. Not a single human auditor ever touches your case. A letter is generated that some sort of discrepancy has been found. You will talk back and forth to computers. That's it. And that's been going on for a very long time. All the expertise, the auditors, the talent, the investigators, it's all for corporations and oligarchs. So if you undermine the IRS, you're not doing anything for yourself. You're actually fattening oligarchs. And this brings up the tax gap, which is, by statute, the IRS is required to calculate what is the difference between what the IRS is supposed to be able to collect and what it actually collects. And today, right now, the tax gap is $1 trillion a year. Okay, think of that number. How to put it in perspective? How much is that? Well, the entire defense budget is $900 billion. So the annual non-collection of taxes is more than the entire defense budget. All right, the average American cheats at a roughly 1% rate. The average oligarch cheats at a 55% rate. So basically, out of that $1 trillion and that incapacity of the IRS to be able to go after them, they are basically pocketing hundreds of billions of dollars a year and making money on that money.
You referenced that in the Castle Bank story, the gentleman whose briefcase was inspected was on his way to see the owner. Let's talk about that owner. Well, that was Burton Cantor. Talk to us a little bit about who Burton Cantor was.
Burton Cantor was a larger-than-life figure in Chicago. He was known at the time by the 1970s to be the most brilliant tax lawyer in all of the United States. And he wasn't just a tax lawyer. He was also an educator. He was a philosopher of kinds. He really viewed taxes as a fascinating realm. So he was a key player, not only as a pioneer in the wealth defense industry, he helped build it. He taught complex tax law at the University of Chicago, not as a permanent faculty member, but from time to time. He wrote a regular column in a tax journal that was avidly read by people. He wrote that column for 30 years, and he basically said, here's how you defend the wealthy. Here's how it's done. So he was not only brilliant in and of himself, but he was a creator of an entire industry. And yet, at the same time, he was vital in the making of, his work helped in the making of the movie One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. He was key in the Rocky Horror Picture Show. He was a philanthropist in art and everything else. Well, he also was the owner of Castle Bank. And the vice president who passed through Miami and got himself embroiled in the middle of this case was on his way to see Burton Cantor in Chicago.
One of the things that I found fascinating was when you talked about Burton Cantor's rationalizations for what he did. The guy was unabashed. To share with us a little bit how he explained why what he was doing was, in his mind, okay.
Yeah. His view was he does not write the laws. He looks at the actual words of the tax code and he says what is allowed and what is not allowed. And so, first of all, he was very proud of having mastered the tax code. And in his view, if Congress writes these kinds of laws and people have the right not to pay taxes, he's going to pursue that to the max. And so his view was he was not doing anything wrong. He was not doing anything illegal. And he himself did not hide what he was doing. Also, the IRS audited Burton Cantor every year from 1961 till his death in 2001 and never won. They never won. They never beat him. And in fact, they tried to get his estate afterward, and more than a decade after he passed away, a Supreme Court decision found in his favor, and Forbes had a headline that said, even from the grave, Burton Cantor defeats the IRS and the Department of Justice. So the man is a larger-than-life figure, truly. But he also had clients who were in the mob. He had clients who were oligarchs. And in fact, years later, we found out that in Castle Bank, even the CIA had accounts that were hidden in Castle Bank. And they were using that money for clandestine operations against Cuba, against Latin American countries. So it turns out Castle Bank was serving all kinds of actors. And Burton Cantor, to his final day, said, what I'm doing is perfectly legal.
Because he helped write the code to make it legal.
Well, that is also true. Yeah. That is also true. And he had worked in Washington in key offices, just as Roger had said earlier. He had worked in key offices and got his training inside the government.
Yeah. So I want to segue on to, you point out that Cantor always won, but you talk about how difficult it is for the government to prevail in criminal tax cases. Why is that?
Well, first of all, the sheer complexity of the tax code means that very few people understand it. And therefore, a prosecutor who looks at a case and says, if I am going to try to go criminally after someone for criminal tax evasion, that means I have to not only master the tax code myself and all the documents and all the complexity that was created by the wealth defense industry to hide the non-payment of taxes, but then I have to be able to convince a jury of ordinary Americans that beyond a reasonable doubt, this was done with intention, and so on. So it is an enormous challenge to be able to bring a criminal case. And then comes the question, well, what about civil cases? Because the IRS can go after you for the non-payment of taxes and try to collect back taxes, fines, penalties, and so on. And that tends to be the direction that the IRS and the Department of Justice go in. But the problem, again, is that they are understaffed. Their budgets are cut deliberately to cripple them so that they cannot put up a powerful case against oligarchs. So imagine you've got a couple people from the Department of Justice walking in court, and on the other side walks in a very, very powerful, wealthy person with 14 attorneys from three different law firms. And there are 140 boxes of documents to go through. And these people are specialized in the tax code in a way that the people on the Department of Justice side simply are not. It becomes a battle over wearing each other down. And ultimately what happens is settlements are arrived at, and those settlements are secret.
Let's talk a little.
The law says, it's amazing. The law says that we do not know when corporations or taxpayers cheat, get caught, and ultimately have to settle. It is considered a matter of privacy.
I want to get to a chapter that you write about the Constitution. And, you know, we always think about the Constitution in Schoolhouse Rock terms, right? This was, you know, sort of a grand experiment that we're going to, like, embody these wonderful democratic principles in a way that has never been seen before on the face of the earth. But you have a slightly more, for lack of a better term, jaundiced view of the way in which the Constitution was deliberately structured to protect the rights of the rich.
Yeah. The story of the Constitutional Convention is, I think, incredibly important for a number of reasons. One is that it lays the foundation for what becomes participatory inequality, oligarchic democracy in America. And one of the things we need to ask ourselves is, we know that the Constitutional Convention happened in the summer of 1787. The question is, why then? Because actually the Articles of Confederation were weak. Many people had been talking for years about the flaws in the Articles of Confederation. But what a lot of people are not aware of is that there were multiple efforts to try to have a constitutional convention, and they failed. One of the reasons is that you had a lot of states where the power was at the state level, and a lot of the leaders in the states were not eager to create a structure over themselves. They had just gotten rid of the British, and they were not eager to create a powerful federal government. So why did they suddenly do it? In fact, six states had actually passed resolutions that there should be no constitutional convention. So this delay could have gone on for a very long time. Why did the framers not only go to Philadelphia, but they ran to Philadelphia in a panic and held the convention? And the answer is that after the War of Independence, there was two things: an economic crisis, which was very deep, a parallel almost to the Great Depression, but it wasn't just an economic crisis, it was a debt crisis. That's what's key. And so you had creditor oligarchs who were Americans, who were also Europeans, and including European governments that had intervened. The debt after the war was enormous. And how was that debt going to be collected from average small farmers? Well, it was through taxes that were collected by sheriffs that came to town. And once the taxes were paid, it was paid to the creditors. That's how the debt was managed. Now, also, so those small farmers had purchased their land and maybe their cattle and so on with credit directly from creditors. There were no banks at the time. What was the crisis? Well, it turns out that many, many of the small farmers were not able to pay the taxes and the debt because they themselves were in an economic crisis. And so they asked their state legislatures for relief because at that time, and again, people forget this, the first prisons in the United States were debtors' prisons. These were inherited from the British. And you couldn't just turn your pockets inside out and say, I'm bankrupt, tough luck. You were thrown into prison with murderers and rapists and others. And it was men, women, and children as young as 2 years old were thrown into debtors' prisons. And so this was happening by the tens of thousands. In some counties, 70% of small farmers lost their land in foreclosures and were thrown into debtors' prisons. So they asked their legislatures for relief. Help us. And in half the states, the legislatures were captured by the small farmers. They were very democratic, very responsive. And in the other half, they were captured by the creditors and oligarchs who dominated them. In the states where the small farmers were in charge, they got relief in the form of printed money. So instead of paying back in silver and gold, you paid back in depreciating paper, which meant oligarchs were getting a haircut. They were the ones bearing the burden of the credit crisis. The question was, who's going to bear the burden? And in the other half of the states, the hard currency states, no relief at all for the farmers. And so they took up arms. That's the shock of Massachusetts, for example. And there were, and we're very familiar with Shays' Rebellion. We learn about it in high school, but we don't actually understand what the context was. Why did these people rise up? And there were 500 Shays' Rebellions across New England. And what did they do? They marched with fife and drum to the city, to the town center, and they did two things. They did not burn down the homes of the rich and the creditors. They did not attack them. Not a single shot was fired. They freed their fellow citizens from the debtors' prisons, and they blocked judges from being able to throw more people in those prisons. That's all they did. The combination of these two things, on the one hand, you had half the states giving relief in the form of paper money, and in the other half, citizens rising up. Those two things caused the framers to panic. And they ran to Philadelphia and said, there is a problem with our democracy. We need to fix it. And so when they got there, Hamilton, Madison, Washington, and the others disagreed about many things, slavery, big states, small states. They all agreed, and these are the words of Alexander Hamilton, there is an excess of democracy in America. We must limit it. And so we have a pyramidal society, but our democracy is too flat. We need a pyramidal democracy as well. And so you had the House of Representatives, which was the only thing that the citizens could vote on. Over that, they created a Senate to check the House. Over that, they put a president with a veto power. And over that, they put a Supreme Court where five people could negate the entire democracy down below it. And so they structured breakers and safeguards into the system so that the people could not do what they were doing, which was using democracy for their own benefit. They were challenging inequality. And that is how we ended up with participatory inequality. It was structured so that we do have consent of the governed. The framers did care about consent of the governed, but they also wanted to make sure that the many could not do anything to the wealthy few.
Somehow I don't remember that Hamilton quote showing up in Lin-Manuel Miranda's Broadway show, but that's... That... But that's neither here nor there. Let me ask you this. Why do you believe we're in an era, you use the term in-your-face oligarchy, which is a great term. Why are we there?
Well, I think we're there for a couple reasons. One is oligarchy has always been there from the founding in the United States, but it hasn't always been visible. It hasn't always been what I'm calling in your face. In fact, the last time oligarchs were this brazen and visible and confident was the Gilded Era. And in that time, the oligarchs were called robber barons. And they felt fully legitimate and empowered to be able to intervene in and shape and distort our political outcomes. Well, here we are now, fully 50 years into one of the most epic periods of rising inequality that we've seen. The oligarchs have been winning for decades on taxes, on all kinds of policies. And then you get Citizens United in 2010, when the Supreme Court says that money is speech. When the Supreme Court says that money is speech. And what they mean by that is the unlimited use of wealth power in our democratic system. And what is the difference between wealth power and what all the rest of us have, which is participation power? We have the ability to vote. We have the ability to speak, to criticize, to march, to assemble, to protest. We have all those civil rights. Oligarchs have all of those rights and powers as well. But they have another superpower we don't have, which is the ability to use incredibly massive wealth to shape our political process. And let me give you just one small illustration, and I could give you many more, an illustration of how that works. First of all, I've already mentioned the wealth defense industry and how deploying money there works to shape the political system and its outcomes. Okay, we all know that we vote on election day. We all know that we get to vote on primary election day. Prior to the primary is something called the wealth primary. And we don't get to participate in that. That starts 2 years before the primary. That's when anyone who wants to be viable has to attract the interest and the okay of the rich. You know, they're called donors. They're even called mega donors. There's no donation going on here. People who give blood are donors, okay? People who invest massive amounts of money in the political system are venture capitalists in the political realm, okay? So I reject the word donor and mega donor. These are oligarchs, or if you want a softer term, these are political investors. And they vet our candidates before we ever get to vote on them. So that's just one way in which the entire political spectrum is narrowed down to policies that are acceptable to the ultra rich.
We've had a wonderful conversation, but before we go, I want to ask you one more question, which is, you obviously believe that addressing inequality is an urgent goal. What do you see are the challenges of addressing it, and what strategies would you advocate to address those challenges?
So two quick things. One, think of it as two kinds of politics we can be in, the politics of the ordinary and the politics of crisis. These are very different historically. Under the politics of the ordinary, it is important to fight incremental, doable battles now. And there are many things that are being discussed that will involve more transparency of oligarchs, doing things about offshore. Okay, so there's many, many things that can be done. Campaign finance is another, to try to fight and claw back limits on the use of money. But also there is what I call the politics of crisis. And during the politics of crisis, I'm talking about major crises, wars, depressions, and so on. It turns out what is possible during these crises is vastly larger. And the key is what I call a politics of preparation, which means the worst thing that could happen during a crisis is that it's a missed opportunity for major change. So we must prepare now ideas, proposals that may seem ridiculous and undoable now, but are very doable under crisis conditions. And let me just throw out two completely wild ideas that everyone will say that's utterly undoable. Number one, the elimination of the Senate.
Okay,
that would be a major step in the right direction. It's not thinkable now. It could be. Also, people are talking about changing the Supreme Court. Oh, let's increase it maybe to 13 people. I would advocate 45 people in the Supreme Court, half of whom are chosen by lottery.
Okay.
You may say, again, why do that? Well, I'm talking about undoing some of the key things that were done at the Constitutional Convention to implant oligarchic power in our democracy. People may laugh about these ideas, and it does seem funny, but I'm not talking about necessarily targeting oligarchs. I'm talking about strengthening democracy, which is very important.
The book is The Blind Spot, How Oligarchs Dominate Our Democracy. Author Jeff Winter spent a good deal of time with us. Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
It's been a delight. Thank you.
Please subscribe to the Mountain Money podcast to stay on top of all the latest episodes of KPCW's Mountain Money.
If you have any ideas for Mountain Money, please shoot us an email at mountainmoney@kpcw.org.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoy the show, make sure you leave a review no matter how you listen. And we'd appreciate it if you clicked 5 stars.